From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. One of the oldest and most robust predictions of the impacts of climate change is that as the planet's atmosphere warms, melting glaciers and greater precipitation will result in sea levels rising. Small island nations around the world know this and are actively feeling its impact. Here in the United States, one community's struggle against rising sea levels is the subject of a new book called The Drowning of Money Island. Located on the southern end of New Jersey, as part of a 40-mile stretch of Delaware Bay beaches in Cumberland County, Money Island is a poor community whose travails are chronicled by my guest, Andrew S. Lewis. He's a contributing writer for Outside. He's also written for the New York Times Magazine and Guernica. And his new book is called The Drowning of Money Island, A Forgotten Community's Fight Against the Rising Seas Threatening Coastal America. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
So for those of us who have lived primarily on the West Coast and don't quite understand the complicated geography of the tiny states clustered around the Northeast, first explain where Money Island actually is. You're talking about the southern part of New Jersey and that particular coastal region there?
Yeah, it's in a very unique place because it's jammed essentially between Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York City, but it's actually very rural. So it's, New Jersey's very small and it's very urban, but that urbanity is sort of condensed towards New York City. And to the south, it's all farmland. It's actually Cumberland County, where Money Island is located, is a large reason why New Jersey is nicknamed the Garden State. It's very agrarian, it's farmland, it's always been that way. It's isolated from the major highway corridors of 95 and the Garden State Parkway. So it's always been agrarian since it was settled by Europeans in the 1700s, and it's sort of remained that way ever since.
So the notion of rising sea levels feels abstract. You know, we're told that Florida's coastline is going to change, etc. But here in this particular case, in this part of the South Jersey shore, it's very, very real. Let's talk about where your story begins and what your personal connection is to this part of the country. It seems as though Hurricane Sandy was a very particular turning point in the geography and politics of this community?
Absolutely. Well, for the book and for me personally, it really does begin with Hurricane Sandy. I grew up in Cumberland County. I grew up along the Bay Shore. I have a lot of childhood memories of going to Money Island, which is the centerpiece of the book. It's a very much emotional story. However, after high school, I moved away and I had been gone for over 10 years. I came back as a reporter to cover the recovery effort in northern New Jersey, Staten Island, Rockaway Beach. And even I, being from South Jersey, I had no idea that the Bayshore communities had been hit by the roughly, after you account for the high tide that night, about 10 to 12 feet of storm surge. So it was the same storm surge that had impacted the north. So I only found out about the Bayshore being decimated by Sandy because on my way home after reporting, my mother and father said, you know, you should go out and check out the Bayshore communities. And that's when I discovered that they had been just as decimated as anything I had seen in North Jersey, Staten Island, and Rockaway Beach. And from that point forward, I began to worry because Cumberland County has sort of always been forgotten by the state. It's the poorest county in the state, so it's always overlooked when it comes to funding and that kind of thing. And so I began to worry that it would be left out of Sandy recovery and Sandy funding, and that's exactly what happened. These are low-lying hamlets along the bay. They've been dealing with sea level rise, since the beginning, and certainly since the 1990s when it's really started to accelerate. The land is also sinking from natural subsidence. So,
oh wow, so that's a twin problem then.
It's a twin problem. It's on mudflats. You know, it's wetlands, it's marshland, and the reason why that area of South Jersey is subsiding is because of glacial retreat. So about 8,000 years ago, the glaciers retreated and land naturally sort of pops up as soon as a glacier retreats and then begins to settle as thousands of years pass. So not only are they dealing with that natural subsidence, but you know they're having accelerated sea level rise problems. So when that, as I mentioned, that 12-foot storm surge came, it was just a cocktail for disaster for those communities.
So the politics of this area, which you said is very rural and very impoverished, does it match the politics of other impoverished rural parts of the country in terms of, you know, being sort of Republican voting, Trump leaning areas?
Yeah, I've thought so much about this because you're absolutely right. It's a very conservative area, but it's unique. And so I spent in the 2.5 years I spent writing the book, I spent countless amounts of time thinking about how they could be such a conservative area when really, especially with the Trump administration, and more specifically with the EPA, all of the policies and the changes that the EPA is implementing cut against their interests. And really it goes back to this idea of just being forgotten. They've always felt sort of outregulated. You know, they always felt like regulation has overpowered any sort of help that the state has given them. It's almost all preserved land out there on the Bayshore. So that means it's owned by the state. So they kind of feel like the state is impeding on their land. And then of course, after Sandy, there was such little help from the state in terms of aid. I mean, all of the aid went to the Jersey Shore. So there were no fans of Chris Christie, Governor Chris Christie, who was also Republican and quite conservative either. So in those days leading up to the election and seeing, you know, driving past one yard after the other with, you know, Make America Great signs and Hillary for prison and all of these dramatic signs, it really just came down to this idea of being forgotten and just wanting to vote for someone who they believed could blow up the system, even if, you know, they maybe don't quite know what blowing up the system means or entails, but that was sort of my conclusion.
So even as this is a microcosm of the impacts of climate change, it is also a microcosm of why communities in the United States have supported a candidate like Trump.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's, again, it's rural communities across this country. It's not just the Bayshore that they feel forgotten at an economic level as much as they do sort of culturally. And I think that played into support for Donald Trump.
So let's talk about the Department of Environmental Protection, or DEP's Blue Acres program, which is a big part of this aid effort that you discuss in your book and how people have responded to it. What was this program? And did it actually fulfill the intention that it had?
Well, so Blue Acres is an open space program that's been around in New Jersey since 1995. Its mandate has always been to acquire properties in flood-prone areas, acquire them, give homeowners competitive rates, buyback rates, demolish the home, and let the land return to open space. After Hurricane Sandy...
And the goal of that being...
The mandate, if you ask the state, is to move people out of harm's way. If you dug a little deeper, it's, you know, to eliminate repetitive flooded properties and, you know, in the state, which are expensive, especially in rural areas.
So insurance rates are a little high for those, I imagine.
Absolutely. Or, you know, in the rural places, a lot of homeowners never got insurance. So, in some places, they were just getting you know, FEMA emergency aid, and you know, some properties in these areas are some of those repetitive flood properties that have, you know, have gotten funding 6, 7, 8 times over the years. So in that sense, it makes sense, the program. After Sandy, it was infused with $300 million in federal funding that came from the Disaster Relief Act package. And what the state did is they had a mandate to acquire 1,000 Sandy-damaged, flood-prone properties across the state to acquire them, give owners pre-Sandy values on the homes, demolish them, and again, you know, return the land to open space. And my point in the book is that nearly 700 properties have now been purchased and demolished across New Jersey in the 7 years since Sandy. All of those properties, every single one of them, are Back Bay properties, riverine properties, streams. Not a single property has been purchased and demolished on the oceanfront, where, of course, we all know the vast majority of Sandy's damage occurred. So what that tells you is it's much easier to target lower to middle income communities. And it's the way FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program are set up now. It's next to impossible to make any changes on the oceanfront, where we really need to start thinking about change.
I'm speaking with Andrew S. Lewis, and we're talking about his book, The Drowning of Money Island, A Forgotten Community's Fight Against the Rising Seas Threatening Coastal America. Tell me about some of the people who you spoke to in researching and writing your book, and what their reaction has been to both the evidence that they see with their own eyes about how their community and their coastline is changing, and their opinion of the government's response.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time with a few people, especially a couple named Mike and Kate Nelson, and you know, they're sort of the camp that says we know something's changing, we're just not sure how much man has to do with it. And you know, I encountered that a lot, you know, in speaking to folks on the Bay Shore. Others are sort of more hardcore and just don't believe that climate change is happening at all. And then, of course, there are other residents that you know, read up on the science and understand that anthropogenic forcing is happening, meaning man is causing this extreme accelerated rate of global warming. So it really kind of, for such a small area, I guess, and thinking about it, there was a smattering of opinions. But what that has done is it's fractured the community, and it's really fractured it at the local government side of things. And that leads to a lot of conflict on the local level. So what that does is that leads to delays in sort of small infrastructure projects that could benefit these small communities. So there's a lot of, unfortunately to say, you know, conflict in these small communities over that really at its core is this debate over, are we responsible for climate change or are we not?
So at the precise time when we need to be taking action to fight climate change, there are still far too many people struggling or to accept that climate change is a thing and is caused by the burning of fossil fuels. If the folks who see that climate change is happening around them claim that it's not due to human activity, what do they think it is due to? Just some long-range cyclical events completely cut off from human activity that, you know, sort of predate civilization and that will come and go?
Yeah, I mean, you're not off. I mean, I think I've heard it a lot. It's just the cyclical argument, right? It's the argument that
we had an ice age before, so we're gonna
have one again. You know what I'm hearing a lot lately is it's in the denial camp is this scientists for sort of a hot minute in the 1970s were saying we might come into a mini ice age and. I see sort of arguments like that, you know, oh, well, scientists were saying that in the 1970s. Well, if you go back, you look at that was sort of debunked and let go very quickly. So yeah, there's a lot of belief that it's just cyclical. But I should also say that, you know, in these places, these are riverine places. The currents of the bay are constantly shifting the shoreline. I mean, shorelines are not meant to be static places, right? They breathe, they move with currents, with winds, with storms. And so on the bay side, you know, they see all of these occurrences of erosion and their shorelines disappearing. But then they look at the Jersey Shore and they say, well, you know, their shoreline's not changing. They always have plenty of beach and this and that. And it's because the Jersey Shore obviously invests millions and actually billions in you know, beach replenishment and all these things. So there's a dichotomy between, you know, the help that the Bay Shore is getting versus the Jersey Shore. And they sort of use that to ignore the realities.
So the couple that you showcased and you talked to, where did they land on this issue?
I think they're coming around to it. You know, we had a lot of candid conversations and in the one sense, I think that in the beginning, they're unsure about how much man is involved. They certainly agree that things are changing. But then on the other side, you know, they just sort of, certainly since Sandy, they've just sort of spent most of their time during the days just trying to rebuild their home and live where they live. And really the topic probably doesn't come up that much. I mean, when I was there as a journalist sort of forcing the issue, we had conversations, but I would venture to guess that it's just not something that's talked about on a regular basis.
So let's talk about a little bit more about this conflict. What, you know, are the kinds of ways in which people have been fighting what the government is doing, but also fighting to get the right response from the government? Because one community can't fight climate change on its own. It can try to mitigate coastal erosion and rising sea tides and adapt to it. So how is Money Island and those areas surrounding the southern Jersey Shore, what are some of the ways in which they think they should be adapting or could be adapting if they have the right kind of government support?
Well, I think on the Bay Shore, in the Bay Shore municipalities, The problem of sea level rise and erosion is so acute and it's so severe. The way that they're responding to it is they just want basic infrastructure. They want the beach replenished. They want a seawall, a jetty, if the state or the Army Corps will give them a jetty. I've been thinking about this a lot lately and just this lack of sort of planning for the future. And even in the rich Jersey Shore communities, no one is really thinking about innovative ways to deal with this. They're even thinking of just beach replenishment and jetties. And a lot of it has to do with there just isn't budgets allocated to someone who can just be dedicated to, you know, being a chief resiliency officer or, you know, someone who can focus their whole day to looking at the long term. And so what's happening is we're stuck in this inertia of reactivism. And it's in the Bay Shore, it's, you know, their governments are tiny. They don't have, it's kind of like with Mike and Kate, what I was just saying, they don't have time to think about the long term. They just are reacting right now. And that's just not going to, there's no longevity in it. I mean, we already see it with Money Island. It's been bought out by this program, Blue Acres, because the state is unwilling to invest any more money in essentially shoring up the shoreline.
Is that program's goal to just buy out the entire community of Money Island and demolish all the homes and essentially, you know, resulting in the relocation of all of the area's residents?
Yes, I would say I don't think they would tell you that if you sort of were to call them up, but they do not want to invest any more money in Money Island or the other small Bayshore hamlets because they don't generate any money for the state, unlike the Jersey Shore communities. And the other issue, what everyone likes to call the unsexy issue, is that the core problem is wastewater. They don't have city wastewater infrastructure there. It's all on septic tanks, and there's literally not enough land left on the properties to install a proper septic tank, you know, that's up to code and all that.
So the area is essentially becoming uninhabitable.
Yeah, I mean, you can't even, in certain wetlands areas, in New Jersey, they have what's called the CAFR zone, which is, it's the coastal zone. It, you know, there's a few more hurdles to jump environmentally when you're developing, right? And that means sort of a more robust, advanced wastewater system. So those are expensive. They take up more space, and you know, if your community doesn't have any money, or you personally don't have any money to install that in your yard, let alone a yard that's disappearing and hardly, you know, there's hardly any room for it, you end up giving up because you're never going to get the permits needed to install these systems.
And so let me ask you, what is the main economic industry? What is the economy of Money Island and those areas based on? And how has that been impacted by the changing coastline?
Yeah, great question. I'm glad you asked. It's the oyster industry. It's fishing. Everyone there who lives there, almost to a T, are either oyster fishermen or they're crabbers, or, you know, they'll gill net menhaden, you know, for bait. The bay, the fish populations in the bay has completely dropped off in the last 20 years. There's a lot of research into that. Researchers haven't pinpointed why, although it's clear to see that the temperatures in the bay have risen due to global warming. The oyster industry is actually in a okay spot right now, but nothing compared to what it was in the sort of the turn of the century. So in the early 1900s, when these communities that we've been talking about were actually some of the richest communities in New Jersey, that oyster industry propped up those communities back then. The oyster populations have gone through two major die-offs since then, one in 1957 and then one again in 1993. That had to do, again, researchers are still looking into it, but it's the changing chemistry of the water. The bay water's heating up. There's all sorts of factors. So the industry that has provided sustenance for these communities is really just really struggling.
So finally, this story that you've written about how this particular rural and impoverished community in South Jersey is both impacted by and figuring out how to struggle with the politics and the changing geography of climate change. How do you see this as a microcosm for the whole country? How do you see this as symbolic of other fights playing out in other parts of the country and possibly even the world? What are some of the lessons that you can share from what you witnessed, from what you researched in writing this book that you hope don't play out, or some warnings that you can share for the rest of the country?
Well, I think the first lesson here is that climate change and sea level rise is happening now, and you can get in your car and you can drive to many places in the United States right now or in the world, coastal areas, and you can see the impacts of climate change right now. In terms of what it portends, it portends mass migration. I mean, the Bay Shore is a microcosm of what we're going to see throughout coastal America, throughout coastal areas across the globe as sea levels rise. I mean, if you look at the very low end, the IPCC projections, it's 1 foot by 2050. That is a tremendously That's a huge amount of water on top of what we're already getting, and that's going to push millions of Americans. I'll stay in the United States. It's going to push millions of Americans out of their low-lying communities from New Jersey to North Carolina to Louisiana. There's already talk at, you know, Del Mar, that's a hot spot in California, closer to you, talking about managed retreat. You know, local governments, state governments, and federal governments are going to have to come together to address moving a tremendous amount of people. So while the Bayshore is just a tiny amount of people in the grand scheme of things, what's happening to them now is a clear window into what's going to happen in coastal areas across this country. And if we don't adapt now, we're going to see things like tipping points in real estate and these kind of cataclysmic occurrences that could, you know, impact the economy. So it's on us to plan ahead finally and, you know, try to deal with this transition in an orderly way and not get, you know, bound up in politics and cost benefit analyses and all of these things that are doing nothing for us but keeping us, like I said, stuck in that inertia.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Andrew. Good luck to you with the book. And is there a website you'd like to give out?
Sure. Thank you, Sonali. It's just my name, AndrewSLewis.com. You can find the book there and other things I've written recently.
We'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Andrew S. Lewis is a contributing writer for Outside. He's also written for the New York Times Magazine and Guernica. We've been discussing his new book, The Drowning of Money Island, A Forgotten Community's Fight Against the Rising Seas Threatening Coastal America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.